No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock with Give the People Their Right to Vote. Hello and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which will attempt to shine a light on the issues that you care about. I'm your host, United States Senator Michael D. Brown, coming to you live from the District of Columbia, America's last colony. I hope my show will start a dialogue with America about the issues that are important to you and affect the lives of all of us. So if you have a question, you can Skype it to us, or you can call in at 888-627-6008, and we'll see if our guest can answer it. And tonight we have a very, very special guest, and that is Dr. Michael McFaul, former ambassador to Russia. Dr. McFaul is a director at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, the Ken Oliver and Angela Namalini Professor of International Studies in the Department of Political Science, and the Peter and Helen Bing Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute. He joined the Stanford faculty in 1995, and he is also an international affairs analyst, NBC News, and a columnist with NBC News, and also a columnist with the Washington Post. He served for 5 years in the Obama administration, first as special assistant to the president and senior director for the Russia and Eurasian Affairs at the National Security Council at the White House, and later as UN ambassador to Russia. Thank you so much, Ambassador, for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, we're happy to have you back. We're honored to have you back. And last week, we saw, oligarch Prigozhin's incursion into Russia. This has been on everybody's, mind since that's happened. He went as far as taking over two southern cities in Russia, I believe. And why did he do that? We've heard everything in the last week. This was a coup. It was a protest. It was contract negotiations. It was a power play. What do you think his motivation was?
Well, the first thing I want to say is I don't want to pretend I know. Mr. Prigozhin and I are not in touch directly. I think, there's still a lot of strange questions that we have to answer. We'll probably have time to get into them later in the program. But starting at the base level, I think the narrative I think is most convincing goes something like this. Remember, he's a hired gun. He's a hired thug, just like you said.
Yep.
But you know what, Senator? Not many people are using the word oligarch. I'm glad you did that, because I think it's important for Americans and anybody else listening to remember that this is a person that made lots of money, probably hundreds of millions, if not more, money working directly with Putin on lots of different things. And this Wagner fighting force is just one of many projects that he's had directly with the Kremlin. This fighting force, they fought all over the place, places in Africa and Syria, were deployed in Ukraine to help out the conventional forces there. You can imagine what that did in terms of relations with the conventional forces. They don't like each other. And July 1st was set as a deadline to liquidate these mercenaries and tell them that they had a choice either to go home or to join the Russian armed forces. And Prigozhin, I think, got nervous. And he thought, if I could go to Moscow and threaten to overthrow the commander of the armed forces, General Gerasimov, and the defense minister, Mr. Shoigu, maybe I could keep my fighting forces intact. So he went on this pretty wild ride, like you said, captured two cities, Rostov and allegedly Voronezh. And Putin got on TV and said, we're going to crush these traitors. It was a very tough speech. And then 5 hours later, he did a deal with this guy. So he didn't crush him. He didn't use escalatory force. And as the time, you know, as we're speaking today, Prigozhin has been given exile in Belarus, and his soldiers can either join him there, his mercenaries, or Putin has now offered them new contracts, either with the Russian military or with other kind of paramilitary fighting forces inside the Russian state.
Well, you know, I think it confuses most Americans who have a sense of what their government is and how it's structured, exactly how this works. I mean, do you have several different power centers in Russia, of these different oligarchs? I mean, it seems like Putin's more like Attila the Hun, who's trying to organize the Mongol tribes, you know, trying to get people together. Is that what he has to do? He has to control these people all the time?
Well, that's a great observation. At the first cut, Putin's in charge and everybody's beholden to him. That I think we can start with that. But if you dig into it, there are divisions within the Russian regime. There are groups that don't like each other, individuals that don't like each other, oligarchs that don't like each other. And this particular group, the Wagner group, you know, for many years, they described themselves as being independent from the state. And they were a private military contracting organization, right? I never believed that ever, by the way. And now Putin himself has told us that they've always been funded by the Russian government. But it gave Putin the ability, the deniability. He could say, well, that's not us. Right. That's a private military operation. By the way, I want to remind your listeners that the first time I remember learning about Prigozhin was a different project. It was called the Internet Research Agency. And that was the Russian organization that intervened in our elections back in 2016, put all kinds of disinformation on social media channels here in the United States to try to help influence the election in favor of Mr. Trump. And the Russian state could say, well, IRA, that's not us. They're independent. That's not the Russian state. So it was the same kind of relationship. But when you think about it for a moment, and I'm glad you compared it to our system, if you've got to do that, that's a sign of weakness, right? If you've got to call in a private army to help you fight your war and your occupation in Ukraine, that is a sign of weakness. And I think, you know, there probably was a time years ago when Putin thought having all these different groups and playing them off to each other empowered him. I think we're now starting to see signs of what happens when you use that strategy for too long. And I think Putin is emerging from this week much weaker than he looked just a week ago.
Well, since they're mercenaries, I mean, can Ukraine hire them? I mean, obviously not. obviously, they're supported by the Russian government. But yeah, we think if they were mercenaries, you know, we could certainly help them make a better offer. And that's a question for you. If Putin, has come out weaker from this, how about the American response? Are we responding appropriately? The president didn't have much to say about it. He said he didn't want to agitate the situation. He didn't want to give Putin an excuse to blame it on the West. But have we made the appropriate response as Americans, the government?
I think the public response has been perfect, which is exactly what the president said. We had nothing to do with this. Secretary of State Blinken said that as well. By the way, some opinion polls just came out today, just an hour ago from Russia. 25% of Russians in this alleged poll, and remember, it's hard to do polling in a country in an autocratic regime like Russia, but 25% said that it was us. I look at that number and say, that's a pretty low number, because usually Putin's blaming us for everything. So I think the public messaging was right. I hope privately we're doing more. And what I would hope is that we are privately trying to go to the fence sitters around the world. Xi Jinping, Prime Minister Modi in India, leaders in the Middle East, lots of leaders in Africa who haven't, they haven't leaned in to help Putin, but they most certainly are not helping President Zelensky or NATO in this war so far. And I think the message needs to be subtle but simple, which is to say, are you really sure Putin is going to be such a reliable partner for you, Mr. Xi Jinping? Look, if you're worried about instability in Russia, and most certainly the Chinese have been worried about that ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, maybe instead of just sitting on the sidelines, you might want to lean in and put some more pressure on Putin to wrap up his war in Ukraine. Because remember, why did this all start? This all started because of the war in Ukraine, because of how badly the war has been going for Russia inside Ukraine. That's the precipitant. And my prediction is that the longer this war goes on in Ukraine, the more likely you're going to have other kinds of rebellions and mutinies inside Russia. So, but, you couldn't do that publicly, of course, but I do think it gives us an opportunity, especially with the Chinese, to say, hey, maybe it's time to be a little more active in trying to end this war.
Well, given that prediction, what happens? Civil war, if that comes to pass, does civil war happen? Does a realignment of oligarchs to stand up against Putin, does that happen? How do you see that playing out? Doesn't Putin have really, really strong support among the Russian people?
Well, great questions, hard to answer because we just lack data. But let me, with that qualification, let me give you a couple of thoughts that I've been thinking about over the last couple of days.
Please.
First, will Putin lose power tomorrow or weeks and months to come? My prediction is no. I don't see that. I don't see a second Prigozhin figure. Now, there have been lots of, hints that maybe he had supporters within the conventional armed forces of Russia, and this General Sadovykin in particular, that allegedly has been arrested. We still don't know that's not been confirmed. So maybe they're lurking, but there's little evidence of that so far. So short term, I don't think Putin's going to be overthrown in a coup. But here's what I would be worrying about if I were Putin. One, the fissures and divide about the war have now gone public with the people fighting the war, right? We have been speculating, I have been for a long time, I've written about this, that there's got to be tensions. Whenever the war is not going well, and I think this is true of all countries, including our own, people look for scapegoats. They want to know why it's not going well, and that has been brewing amongst these groups. Prigozhin in particular has been attacking the defense minister Shoigu, the head of the armed forces, Gerasimov, and blaming them for how poorly the Russian army has been fighting in Ukraine. And that I don't think is going to go away. I think that's going to keep, it's not going to lead to a coup, but I think it's going to be hard for Putin to correct that dynamic anytime soon. With respect to society more broadly, again, it's almost impossible to know what Russians really think. And, just to remember, it's a dictatorship. It's a very tightly monitored dictatorship. The Russian people know that it is. So, some stranger calls you from Moscow and says, hey, Michael, I'm out in Vladivostok. Mikhail, it would be in Vladivostok, not Michael. He says, Mikhail, what do you think of Putin? There's only one rational answer to that in Putin's Russia. You just say you support the president. You do not want to reveal what you really think. But for those people who try to dig deeper into this, sociologists who I know in Russia, I think there's a lot of shallow support for the president, but not deep support for Putin. So yes, you know, as most countries do, they rally around the flag when they go to war. He's been their leader for 23 years, so they don't really know any other leader. It's not like they're going to the ballot box next year and choosing between the guy that started the war and the candidate who's against it. They don't have that option. But I think it's for most Russians lukewarm support for that war. And then on the extremes, you have the hardcores that want to beef up the fighting forces in Ukraine and think that they're not doing enough. But you also have on the other side, and most of their leaders are in jail right now, but, you know, I might be my guess about 20% of the Russian people, and these are mostly young, urban, educated, rich Russians that have never supported this war. They're just being quiet about it because repression's costly. And so in the early phases of the war, you saw tens of thousands of these people demonstrating. Now they're not demonstrating because you can go to jail for 25 years. One of my friends just was sentenced for 25 years for being critical of the war. That's Volodya Karamurza. But I don't think it means that they've changed their attitude about the war. You know, that I think makes the support for the war rather soft.
Well, given the fact the authoritarian regime and Putin's record for going after people that he doesn't like, is Prigozhin safe in Belarus? Will Lukashenko protect him? I mean, isn't he, doesn't he always do what Putin wants him to do? I mean,
well,
I'd be worried if I were
him. I think he should be worried. That's right. And most certainly, you know, Putin can't go after him right now because he's, you know, he's a bit of a hero, right? When his forces pulled out of Rostov, citizens there were cheering them. I mean, think about how crazy that is. You know, this is the 10th largest city in Russia. And when these rebellious mutineers took over, when they left, the local forces cheered because they were considered the ones talking honestly about the war, and they were the ones fighting hard in the worst battle of all so far in the war in Ukraine in the city of Bakhmut. So if something happened to Prigozhin right now, you know, Putin runs the risk of making him a martyr. But in the longer run, after he's been sitting there in Belarus for a while, yes, I would be worried. And Putin, you know, in a very famous video, I think it was from 2018 or so, he was asked by the moderator of a TV program, do you forgive people? And he said, yes. But he said, one category I don't forgive people, and that's traitors. And, you know, he called Prigozhin a traitor on national TV last week. And remember, not only has he gone after traitors, alleged traitors, I don't want to presume all these people are actual traitors inside his country, but he's even reached around the world. And, you know, in 2006, he killed somebody he thought was a traitor, Litvinenko in London. 2018, he tried to kill another alleged traitor, Sergei Skripal. And even recently, there was, you know, reporting, I can't, you know, I'm just reading the news here, I can't confirm it, but that an alleged traitor who's been living in Miami, Putin actually sent a team to try to kill him. So he's demonstrated that he's willing to violate the sovereignty of other countries. And most certainly, as you rightly pointed out, Lukashenko is not an independent actor in Belarus, in my opinion. And I think that would be a place that I would be very nervous to think of as my retirement home if I were Mr. Prigozhin.
So does he have to, do you think he has to escalate hostilities in response to Ukraine over all this? I mean, is it a thing where he has to reestablish himself and make sure that this traitor doesn't get away and also come back harder against the Ukrainians? Do you think there's an incentive for him to do that?
Well, I think he would like to do that. Yes.
Yeah.
but I think he would like to do it, but then you just asked exactly the right question, Kenny. I don't see their capabilities to do that, short of using a nuclear weapon, and I see, you know, little rationality for that, and our intelligence community has briefed that that's a very unlikely prospect, and I think that would be a catastrophic event for Putin. So I don't think he'll do that. So I don't think he has a lot of great opportunities for escalation because he doesn't have those capabilities. If he had those capabilities, he would be using them already. But I think that also raises an important lesson, at least for me, from this recent crisis that has to do with our policy towards Ukraine. And, you know, if you go back, and I've been a part of this debate, you know, with the Biden administration and with others, there's been a nervousness about giving this weapon or that weapon, now leading up to the next NATO summit in Vilnius, whether they should extend an invitation to Ukraine or not. And the worry is always, well, if we do that, Putin's going to escalate. If we send them long-range rockets, Putin's going to escalate. If we send them Patriots, we were worried that we debated that, missile defense system, he's going to escalate. We send them jets, he's going to escalate. We send them tanks, he's going to escalate. And I think two things we've learned over this horrible, tragic, barbaric war. One, at each one of those junctures, and I want to be clear, like those are hard calls that the Biden administration has to make. But Putin didn't escalate when we added an additional weapon system, because I don't think he has escalatory measures that he can take. And second, so he didn't have the capabilities, but second, in this standoff with Prigozhin, Putin could have escalated. He could have upped the ante. He was the proverbial rat in the corner that needed an off-ramp, right? And instead of escalating, what did he do? He negotiated. He negotiated with a guy who just literally hours before he labeled a traitor. And I'm not suggesting that that's what he'll do automatically in Ukraine as well, but the assumption that we have had in the debate about this horrific war, at least the debate I've been involved in, that, you know, A, Putin will escalate if we do this, that, and the other, and B, you know, he can't lose. I've heard that so many times. He can't lose. He needs to save face. He needs an off-ramp, and oftentimes that's code words for Zelensky needs to give him some territory, and then he'll just mellow out. Well, that's one scenario where the war might end. I don't know. But I can see now another scenario, that maybe Putin will begin to negotiate, not when there's stalemate on the battlefield, but when he begins to feel like he's losing. And that most certainly was the case in this standoff with Prigozhin over the last week.
Hmm. Well, does he is the threat from NATO that if he uses what he's calling a conventional battlefield nuclear weapon, which I can't believe there is such a thing, if he were to go to that extreme, would NATO step in? You think that would be the thing that would cause NATO to react, you know, militarily?
I don't know. I know that the Biden administration has debated these options since the very beginning of the war, and they're hard options. Do you do nothing and take it to the United Nations Security Council and try to just win there? Do you do a limited strike against whatever general launched that tactical nuclear weapon? And it is kind of hard to get your head around it, isn't it, that there's a nuclear weapon that could be useful on a conventional battle. But that would be, you know, option number two in an escalatory way. Or three, these could be all sequential, right? They could all happen. But three, remember, in these debates about escalating or not, the Biden administration has chosen not to do certain things to avoid that scenario. But if Putin uses a nuclear weapon, then, you know, all bets are off. They can send they can send the Ukrainians everything, and particularly these ATACMS weapons, these long-range conventional rocket systems, which the Ukrainians believe could really change the dynamics on the battlefield. We've been reluctant so far, but if he uses nuclear weapon, there's no reason not to give those. And same with F-16s and others, you know, want to go right straight to F-35s. So that Putin has to think about. And then the other piece I think he has to think about and is not just the response from NATO, but what does Xi Jinping say at that moment? I just find it hard to believe that that wouldn't be the moment where the Chinese just say, you know, we signed up with this guy. He's been crazy for a while, but now he's really crazy. We don't want to have anything more to do with this. That's something I think Putin has to think about. And then finally, I mean, I'm just speculating here, of course, because nobody, or at least I don't know, maybe Bill Burns, ahead of the CIA, knows. I used to work with Bill. He's an incredibly competent guy, but I don't know even if they know. But in the speculatory space, I think Putin has to worry, would his military leadership carry out such an order? If I were General Gerasimov, I'm not sure I would want to be known as the first general, the first military officer since 1945 who used a nuclear weapon. I just would have to think twice before I would sign up to that mission statement. So the divisions and the tensions that you're already seeing within the military inside Russia, I think would be exacerbated in the event that there would be some discussion about the use of a nuclear weapon.
Well, what you bring up, earlier you mentioned Modi, who is the leader of India, who has the world's largest standing army and is a little bit crazy in my humble opinion. But are we seeing a new worldwide alignment here? What's to keep the – I mean, I wasn't around during the Second World War, Dr. McFaul, but it feels a little like, you know, watching the Axis countries come together, right? Is there any chance that China, Russia, North Korea, and India – will form a new alliance to try to shift power from the West to Asia? Are we ready if that happens? Is CETO a strong enough organization?
Well, that is certainly a scenario that we want to prevent. And that's why I think we need to use this crisis, this Prigozhin mutiny crisis, as an opportunity to help us, fuel, nurture divisions, first and foremost, between the Chinese and the Russians. And I think we have an opportunity to do that, and we should be leaning in quietly, of course. This is not something you do in public, but through private channels, I think that is something you want to do. And you want to say, do you really want to go down with this ship, with this crazy guy in Moscow? Remember, we don't think of you as being as belligerent as Russia is. And make no mistake, we have a long-term competition with China that's going to last for decades, and how to do that smartly. That's the book I'm writing right now, Lessons from the Cold War for How to Deal with China Smartly in the 21st Century. But China to date is most certainly not as belligerent as Mr. Putin is, right? They haven't invaded their neighbor in the way that Putin has done now three times: Georgia 2008, Ukraine 2014, and now this giant full-scale invasion that he started last year. Second, Modi. One thing that's been frustrating for me as somebody involved in these debates, not just here in the United States but around the world, is countries like India and in parts of Africa, and I don't want to generalize, it's more complicated, but there are many leaders and societies that do not accept what I think is self-evident, that this is a war of colonization. This is a war of annexation. This is a Russian war of imperialism. Remember, Ukraine was part of the Soviet Union in 1991. Mm-hmm. Then they got their independence, and we all celebrated that, and Moscow recognized their independence. And now 30 years later, Putin is trying to subjugate them again. You know, that's, I don't see how that's any different than the British going back to Nigeria, you know, after they declared their independence, or going back to India, or the French going back to Algeria, or the Portuguese going back to Angola. Those were all imperial empires, but then there was a phase of decolonization that the world celebrated. And now in Russia, Putin's trying to recolonize a country that used to be subjugated to the Russian Empire and the Soviet Empire, both, by the way. And yet that is not a framework that the Indian government or society views this war as. Not the same is true in South Africa, same is true in lots of countries in the Middle East. And that's disappointing to me. But again, I would hope that we would be using this crisis to try to make a new run at that, to say, look, this is crazy. Look at what this guy is doing. This is like that earlier period. And now it's coming back to cause trouble in the metropole, right? I mean, remember, that's what happened, for instance, with the Portuguese Empire. They fought these wars forever in Mozambique and Guinea-Bissau and Angola. And eventually that led to a coup d'etat, and then democratization, thankfully, came out of that. But it led to turmoil in Lisbon. And I think that could easily happen here in Russia. And if you're a leader who does not want instability in Russia, whether it's Modi or Xi Jinping or any other leader that has relationships with Russia right now, you might want to try to put pressure on Putin to end this war. By the way, that might be Putin's best option for staying in power, ending the war now before it brings him even more problems back home.
Well, the Taiwanese have to be, I would assume, be apoplectic about all this stuff in Ukraine, because I would think that they imagine that if he's successful, this might open the door for the Chinese to do exactly the same thing that, you know, haven't they used the same rhetoric about Taiwan that Putin has used about Ukraine? You know, and they feel like, you know, would this give them the opportunity, you think, to move and try to reunite with, or actually take over Taiwan, invade Taiwan? And if they moved in that direction, do you think we'd keep our promise to intervene?
Well, that's, to me, these theaters are most certainly intertwined. I was in Taiwan last August and with a delegation from Stanford, and we met with President Tsai. We met with all of her leadership, and we met with the opposition. And I found no group of people that I know on the planet cheering for Ukrainian victory louder than the people of Taiwan, because they understand exactly what you're talking about, Senator. If Putin, God forbid, prevails in Ukraine, that is going to embolden Xi Jinping. And he's going to look at, if that happens, we're going to look weak. And we're going to look like we were feckless. And I'm not an expert on American domestic politics like you are, but I just am surprised when I hear some of your Republican colleagues say, I want to be tough on, I'm tough on China, but we should stop funding the Ukrainians, as if those two things are not interrelated. Because if we prevail, if Zelensky prevails, let me make this clear, and the Ukrainian warriors prevail on the battlefield, and they push Putin out, that will compel Xi Jinping to think a lot harder about a military invasion of Taiwan. And that's exactly what we want. But conversely, if it goes the other way, we're going to look weak And even in the eyes of the Taiwanese, by the way, if suddenly we're pulling out of Ukraine and decide, well, you know, we're tired of this now, we want to move on to other things, that will undermine their belief that we are going to be there for them. And that is also destabilizing. That might lead them to do some things out of weakness. So I actually think the stakes of this war, tragically, are much bigger than just about Ukrainian security. It's much bigger than just about European security. I think it has implications for what might happen in Taiwan. And I would add to it an ideological dimension too. Obviously, Putin's an autocrat and he invaded a democratic country. If an autocrat succeeds, that's bad for small D Democrats all over the world. That's bad for the Taiwanese, but it's bad for the Belarusians. It's bad for the Iranians. I know people in all these countries, Armenia, Georgia. If we somehow allow an autocrat to use force to undermine democracy, that becomes a very destabilizing world. Conversely, if the Democrats win, that is a positive signal for small D Democrats all over the world. And we need some good news on that front. You know, it hasn't been a great decade and a half for democracy in the world. So a win in Ukraine could actually be a very positive signal well beyond the borders of Ukraine.
Well, and, you know, I've got to be honest, I think the Republicans are just looking for issues. I think they understand exactly what you just said, Mr. Ambassador. I think that they're just looking for ways to keep attention off their, Republican candidate for president, the leading Republican candidate for president before he gets indicted for something else. I mean, We keep on trying to knock them off the front page. They keep on trying to knock them off the front page. But thanks to his diligence, he keeps on resurfacing, right? So I think that they understand that, really. They're just like, because there's always been that element. Hasn't there been in America? We were isolationists before the Second World War. It took an attack from the Japanese to change a public opinion and so there's always been that element in American politics, and I think you're just playing to that. Let me ask you, Secretary Blinken says we haven't seen the last of this. He said, you know, there are serious cracks, but it's not over yet. So what do you think the next thing is? What are we going to see next? And what's our response likely to be, do you think?
Well, I do agree with the Secretary Blinken that Putin is now in a weaker position than he was before. I watch Russian TV, so you don't have to. Even his propagandists are kind of all over the place now. You know, they don't even know what their talking points are anymore. Some have argued that he's emerged stronger than ever because they've routed out these, you know, they've discovered these traitors and now they're out of the system. And, you know, maybe that's true in the short term. Some are even saying this is all, planned and, you know, Putin the brilliant strikes again. But even some of his most loyal propagandists agree with Secretary Blinken that the president looks weaker. And it just, you know, just think about if this had happened in America, where, you know, just a couple hundred kilometers, 150 miles outside of Washington, thousands of armed forces were on the march. And remember, nobody was stopping them, right? That's the other mystery. Right. There are many mysteries, but a key one for me is, why did the border guards between Ukraine and Russia not stop these guys? Why did they get to Rostov and took over the military headquarters? And that's the headquarters from which the war is being conducted. That's the main headquarters for the fighting forces in Ukraine. And not a single shot was fired. And that just makes me wonder, are there more sympathetic views that are inside the military, inside the intelligence services, perhaps, that supported what Mr. Prigozhin is doing? So I have no ability to know when there'll be another kind of a moment like this, but I do think it's jarring for those that thought that Putin was, you know, the strong man and all powerful. And remember, Senator, he has been cultivating this image for decades, right? We've all seen the image of him, the photo of him riding his horse without his shirt off, fishing with his shirt off with Shoigu, by the way, the Minister of Defense. He has been cultivating that image of the Kremlin strongman for a long, long time. This was a bad week for that image.
Yeah, I think we all, I can't remember if it was Annie Leibovitz photo or what, but I think that really is the image Americans have of him, of sitting on a horse without his shirt on and, you know, as a strong man. But let me ask you, when stuff like this happened, I've been involved in a lot of presidential campaigns over the years, and when a crack like this opens up in a presidential campaign, it brings out all the opposition. So has the groundwork been laid for another coup? Are people, I can't believe there aren't other oligarchs over there saying, hey, look, you know, Prigozhin got this far. Maybe it's time for a realignment. Do you think the groundwork's been laid by this offensive?
Well, I'd say a couple of things. One, Prigozhin showed that it can be done. And, you know, others say, well, he didn't have enough forces. They would eventually been destroyed, but they weren't. I think that's important to realize. And you don't need, you know, massive armies to lead coups all the time. History is full of those. And I think it should remind people in Russia that when you got all your forces fighting in Ukraine, they're not defending Moscow or Voronezh or Rostov. And, you know, that may have some reverberations about the debate about the war. Second, to the oligarchs, you know, I think it probably exacerbates their anxiety about staying with Putin. So, you know, I used to know quite a few of these people when I worked in Russia. You know, I've been on the sanctions list for almost a decade now, so I haven't been there for a long time. But these are not fighters. These are people that want to make money. And I think what I'll be watching for are defections of the oligarchs, where they're trying to bail out of Russia, trying to cash out, find a way to get off of our sanctions list in return, you know, for, you know, giving money to Ukraine. There's some of them have been making those kind of arguments kind of in the very subtly, but I've got to wonder about that crew, where they're thinking this ship is sinking. We don't want to be here for the next time when a Prigozhin like figure might succeed.
Well, you know, I have a friend who just came back from a long assignment, security assignment in Poland. And he said to me, the Poles are ready to fight. He said, they're all up in arms. You know, is there, do you think there could be pressure put on other NATO partners that feel threatened by all this to intervene in a more profound way? I know the Poles have done a lot. As far as they're concerned, to help, along with the alliance that's been put together by the Americans. But you think there's any danger of like a single actor or a group of actors, maybe from former satellite countries, being upset enough to, you know, to try to intervene in some fashion? Or is that unlikely?
Yeah. I think it's unlikely, although individuals have done so already, right? So there are individuals, including from the United States, who've decided to go and fight. There's a special regiment that they have, I can't remember what it's called, inside Ukraine, where they're fighting there. And so you might see more inspired to do that. What I'm hoping for is less of that and more of an effort now from the NATO alliance, including the Biden administration, to lean in and give some of these weapon systems that they've been holding back on. And in particular, this thing called the ATACMS, which is this long-range missile system. They did deploy the HIMARS, which is a missile system with a shorter range. And it's been, from what I understand from Ukrainian colleagues, fantastically successful, been very effective. It's very accurate. It's hitting depots of Russian weapons all the time. But now they want to push those supply lines back farther with the use of ATACMS. Now, the administration, from what I understand, has been nervous about that because ATACMS can reach the Russian territory, and they worry that that could be the escalatory move that could cause Putin to up the ante, as we already discussed before. But I do think that this idea that Putin will escalate all the time, we just saw, is not true. And I think as the leaders of NATO meet, I hope that this crisis will give them a sense that we got to accelerate the end of this war. We don't want to be fighting this war, quote unquote, as long as it takes. We want to look for ways to finish it as fast as possible, in part because we worry about stability inside Russia.
Well, we're starting to run out of time here, and I've got to ask you, as a long-term professor, this I'm switching gears here and going to domestic policy, but what do you think about the Supreme Court decision about the student loans? I'm somebody, I've heard both sides of this argument, Dr. McFaul, and I paid off all my student loans, but you know what? My student loans were at, I think they were NDSL loans that were at like 1.5%. And I think after keeping the loans for like, because they didn't come due the whole time I was in as an undergraduate and graduate student, they never, I got them my first 2 years in college and they didn't come due until I graduated from graduate school. So I had the money for six years. And I think I accumulated, by the time I paid it back, like $150 in interest. These kids are now borrowing money at 8%, and it's they'll loan money for my mortgage at 2.5%, but they're charging my three children 8%. They're all in debt. Doesn't this have a serious impact on our economy that we've kept so many people in this much debt? Because you give an extra dollar to Amazon, it just goes into the bank. You give an extra dollar to somebody that needs money and they spend it helps the economy. So
right,
you think we're doing the right thing here?
Well, Senator, you know more about that than I do, but I can tell you as a professor here at Stanford, two things. One is we want to get our students spending money as fast as possible and not just putting money into loans. And, it's not the super rich that are hurt. It's the middle class students here at Stanford that are the ones that have to take these large loans, as I did too, by the way, as a Stanford student a long time ago. And that's not good for the economy as a whole. But there's another place that I see it very directly that I think is not being understood in the national debate. And it's what do you do when you get out of college?
Yeah.
When you get out of college and you got $30,000 or $40,000 in debt,
right.
You don't go to Teach for America. You don't go work for members of Congress. You don't go work for the non-governmental organizations. You don't go join the State Department. In other words, it has a direct impact, and I see it every single day with my students because they want to do public service. But when the private sector is offering them multiples more and they're carrying all this debt, then they just say, Professor, I'm sorry, you know, I would like to do that public service work, but I just can't afford it. So I got to go to, you know, I got to go to New York, or I got to go to the Googles of the world. And that, I think, is something that is missing in this debate, because those students have choices, and it means they're not doing the things that I think we as a society would benefit from, having the best and the brightest go and work in the public sector. We're just missing that opportunity by burdening them with all this debt.
Well, I think you're right. And as somebody that just put three young people through college, I can tell you it entered into their decision, my son's decision about going to college. He did go and he got a bachelor's degree, but, you know, he thought long and hard about the debt. You know, I think it's keeping people out of school that should be there out. And I just think it's horrible.
Yeah.
But we've run out of time. And let me ask you, is there anything you wanted to add that I haven't asked you?
No, fantastic conversation.
You know what?
We covered a lot of stuff. It's a complicated stuff, but I think we did a good job of going through the nuance. And it's great, Senator, that I'm on TV a lot. I was just on TV right before you. Sometimes you don't get to get into nuance when you only have a couple minutes. It's nice to be able to talk in paragraphs, because this is these are complex things, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk about them in a complex way.
Well, you're always welcome here, Ambassador. I appreciate your service to America. Thank you so much. You have such a distinguished career. It takes us 15 minutes to figure out what to call you, doctor, ambassador, a senior advisor to the president. You have a lot of titles, and we're just honored that you would take the time to be with our audience tonight. And we're leaving you tonight with a song that we dedicate to the people of Ukraine on behalf of our show and Ambassador Michael McFaul. Thank you so much. Continued success.
Sure.
Enjoy the 4th of July, because I know, much like me, you're proud to be an American, and this is a time for all of us to take a moment to reflect on what a great country this is. So have a great time. I hope you have a hot dog and
thank you
get some decent fireworks. Okay, thanks again.
All right, thanks for having me. Yeah.
See you next
Bye-bye.
Week. Bye. And this goes out to the people of Ukraine. Thank you, Doug.
Give the people their right to vote. Give the people their right.